This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Learn more at augustine.edu/MACE. Timothy Carney is Senior Fellow at American Enterprise Institute and author of Alienated America, The Big Ripoff, and Obamanomics. His new book is Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. That's our topic today. Welcome, Mr. Carney.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Well, the preface covers a regular gathering called Friday Night Lights. Just jumping right in here, what is Friday Night Lights and what does it represent or enact on your theme?
At first, what I thought Friday Night Lights was when we signed up for it was just t-ball and youth baseball at a local parish, the parish next door to ours. It was called St. Bernadette's. When I got there, I realized soon what Friday Night Lights really was, which was a place to bring your children and ignore them while you socialize with other adults. And not just ignore your t-ball player, but the older kids are playing wall ball and the younger kids are climbing on the playground. And there's somebody, some teenager probably watching the playground. And it was a place to build community, to be a regular place to raise your kids, but not have to have your eyes and your hands and your mind constantly on them. And that is really something that a lot of suburban, middle-class, upper-middle-class parents desperately need. And it's part of the culture that I talk about in Family Unfriendly, the culture that makes it harder to raise kids. Part of it is, for various reasons, we either our time is demanded or we think our time and attention is demanded for the sort of things that when you and I were growing up, it was more community, friends, older brothers, younger sisters, etc. And so Friday night on the field, whatever we called it, what it represented was a place to bring your kids, ignore them, know they would be safe, get to know other adults.
And it's very important for kids to know I'm being ignored. There's no surveillance taking place right now.
Yeah, so the lack of independent play, meaning parents, coaches, teachers aren't telling you what to do and aren't watching your and refereeing your play, the lack of independent play is a chief, if not the major cause of the rise in childhood anxiety today. That was from an op-ed in the Journal of Pediatrics earlier this year. And this is about helicopter parenting. It's about overambitious parenting. I think that there are sort of anthropological roots to this, but some of it is just what trickles down from our social media. Some of it is actually the result of having fewer kids. When people have fewer kids, they then invest more time. That sounds like a good thing, right? Well, I think it ends up being part of the max effort parenting leads to max anxiety childhood.
Yeah, well, this is one of the important things about your book, and I'll tell our listeners it's a very good read. It's got a lot of concrete anecdotes, illustrations, examples to go along with some of the main points about parenting. And what you just said about that op-ed, look, watching over your kids, that actually makes them feel insecure in a way. That actually raises their anxiety. But, you know, the helicopter parents, when you said the term overambitious parenting, the helicopter parent phenomenon. You talk about something like the travel team trap. And your advice is, hey, in chapter two, relax, lighten up, lower your expectations. Now, Tim, this is contrary wisdom, right?
Yeah. So it's being countercultural. We have a culture that teaches parents that their job is to make sure their kids get these certain worldly accomplishments, getting into a great school or D1 scholarship, that the point of baseball for kids is becoming the best shortstop in the county, you know, really climbing to the next level. There's this lacrosse program that I sometimes run into in my area here around Washington, D.C., called Next Level Lacrosse. And I always laugh at that. That's the idea of putting 8-year-olds in lacrosse, is to get them to the next level rather than to run around, to learn how to win with grace, learn how to overcome adversity, learn how to lose with grace, learn how to be a role player on a team. There's so many great things, even about lacrosse. I joke because I'm a baseball guy, but there's so many great things. But next level lacrosse turns into travel lacrosse, turns into you've got a tournament in Delaware every other weekend, turns into an erosion of family culture. And
that's the travel team trap. Right?
The travel team trap is one of the core elements of our family unfriendly culture. And that a lot of listeners out there probably remember as a kid, you played Little League, you rode your bike to the game, and maybe your mom came only when grandma was in town or if it happened to be a nice night out. You didn't always have to be there. You didn't have to be putting the kids in the very best. Better than next level lacrosse, I say, would be next door lacrosse. Whatever's easiest and fits into your family culture, rather than what's going to make him be the best possible athlete.
Now, one of the roots of the problem with the excessive, overambitious surveillance is, you say, quote, bad risk assessment. What is the bad risk assessment? Why are parents so frightened?
Part of it is that they just believe that their child can be kidnapped if you leave them alone for a little bit. It's the national news. There could be, one or two actual stranger abductions in all the United States and America in a week. And it seems like, oh gosh, that's a lot, right? Then you realize there's a 1 in a million chance of any child being abducted by a stranger. There's a lot higher chance of them being struck by lightning. We don't try to protect our kids from that. And there are actual dangers, you know, driving on the highway, giving your 16-year-old the car keys, and having a swimming pool in your backyard. All of these are actual dangers that we need to worry about. Parents worry about, getting abducted, and that mindset means you don't give your kids freedom. You don't let your 10-year-old walk down to the playground to play with other kids, and you worry constantly about it. And again, that's parents are exhausted, and children then are anxious, and they don't develop the independence. But the idea of doing, and it even goes to the pregnancy, where people say, okay, well, you can't have any alcohol, you can't have caffeine, don't have turkey sandwiches, anything that could introduce the tiniest little risk, in some cases, gets written off as way too risky to do. And so all of these are bad risk assessment, not realizing that the anxiety and the lack of independence that you're imposing to avoid these minuscule risks have a much higher risk of imposing harms on your kid. Letting them go and being more relaxed is probably better for both of you.
Another element in your book that is illuminating is the way in which government actions or policies really aggravate these tendencies. You talk about the phenomenon of car hell, and that the government wasn't entirely not involved in creating that. What went on there?
Yeah, so car hell is something every sort of modern parent understands, that you have to buckle your kids in and out of the car. You have to take them everywhere you go, first of all. Certainly never leave them in the car, even for half a second. So you're buckling them, you're unbuckling them, you're reaching under their sweaty butts to a slurry of chewed up goldfish and and some lollipop from last Halloween. And to rebuckle them, sort of cutting the cuticles on your hands. Then they start melting down. Maybe they're potty trained, but it doesn't matter in the car. You have to drive them everywhere because a lot of places aren't built to be walkable. Part of the car hell is the car seats. It's actually one of the studies I cite in Family Unfriendly is about how car seat mandates actually drove down the birth rate in a very specific way. Married couples with two kids were less likely to have a third if they lived in a place at a time that mandated those big bulky car seats and booster seats for little kids, because you couldn't fit a third one in there. So car seats as a form of contraception is something multiple social scientists have looked into. They found that it saved a tiny amount of lives, and, you know, thank God they saved those lives, but that they prevented a hundredfold, a thousandfold more babies from being born. And So all sorts of policies, but I mostly point to the lack of sidewalks, the way our towns are built to, you know, everybody drives from an attached garage to a strip mall. Not only do you not know your neighbors, which is rough because it takes a village to raise a child, but also you have to drive your kids absolutely everywhere and life just becomes a lot more less pleasant. That leads to parents feeling isolated and alone. And so parents there's always a risk of that, but I think in our modern culture, and partly because of car dependence, parents feel they have no connection to their neighbors. A stay-at-home mom, which is becoming rarer, part of the reason is because it really involves just sitting home alone with a couple of babies. And a newborn baby, my wife absolutely loves that, but at some point you need human connection with adult humans, and car dependency gets in the way of that.
You mentioned the fertility issues with the car seats, and you go into a lot of demographic patterns in the book. We were all set for a second baby boom, you say, in 2007. And then the 2008 economic crash happened, and, you know, birth rates fell. I guess that's to be expected. What happened to birth rates when the economy improved a few years later, and why?
The birth rates just kept crashing, which not only shouldn't have happened, because in the short term, birth rates do correlate with the economy, but it didn't happen in 2009, 2010. But also, we had the millennials were coming into the age of marriage and childbearing, and the number of babies still kept falling because the birth rate was falling so fast, even while the number of potential parents was growing.
Yeah.
So when that first happened in 2009, 2010, 2011, Jonathan Last was an author. He wrote a book called What to Expect When No One's Expecting. And people said, come on, you have a recession and then a couple more years. You're overreacting. Huh. Well, from 2012 now to 2019, right before the pandemic, the economy had some of the best years ever. 2019, we hit a record low in birth rates. The total fertility rate is sort of the best measure. It's births per woman of childbearing age. It fell down to less than 1.7 before the pandemic hit, down from 2.1, which is the replacement level when my wife and I started having kids in 2006, 2007. So as the economy got better, as employment got great, as the stock market hit record highs, it kept falling. Why? I argue again, it's the title of the book, Family Unfriendly. We have a family unfriendly culture, and the culture got more family unfriendly as over the last 15 years. And there's 100 reasons, and I go through them in the various chapters. It has to do with technology. It has to do with the fact that it's self-reinforcing.
I wonder if we should jump ahead, because I wanted to ask you about we'll get to the technology issue. Go ahead.
I'll just finish up quickly here.
Yeah.
It's self-reinforcing. When people have fewer babies, society increasingly gets built without babies and kids in mind. Yeah. And so, again, fewer sidewalks, fewer playgrounds, cafes that are not fit for kids, etc. It becomes weird to bring your kids to an event. And so for this part, I point to places that are different. Mormon places in Utah and Idaho, Israel. I traveled to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which is a pretty secular city, and then Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods in Maryland near where I used to live. And in these places, you just see these tiny little things. Just, again, the crosswalks, the bus drivers go out of their way to make sure the little kids are doing well. It becomes normal for little kids to walk to school, so then more little kids walk to school. And so bit by bit, a family-unfriendly culture becomes more and more family-unfriendly, and that's what's been happening for the last 15 years.
Let's pause for a moment to hear from one of our valued sponsors. Ralston College is an inspiring revival of the traditional university, dedicated to honest and intense study of the humanities. Admissions are now open for its Master's in Arts program in the humanities in 2024-25. The first term is based in Greece, where students will be immersed in ancient and modern Greek, reading Homer, Plato, John's Gospel, and Kavafi. The following three terms will be located in the historic city of Savannah, Georgia. This year, under the theme Nature, the great cultural achievements of the Western tradition will be studied and the most profound and enduring questions of the human condition addressed. 35 places are available for master's students, and full scholarships will be offered to all successful applicants. Please visit ralston.ac for further details. Side question. Are there, you're in D.C., you have a lot of political involvements with policy and so forth. Are there any leaders in either party in D.C. worried about this, knowledgeable about this?
So it's funny. American politicians have not cared about falling birth rates until about the last 12, 15 months, or maybe it was COVID. European politicians have been worried about this, but absolutely not. And I think that on both sides, that on the left side, you have people whose fondness for feminism gets in the way of them even hinting that maybe somebody should have one more kid. And on the right side, I think there's a worry about, if you have your kids, you should just care about only you have responsibility. It's not the responsibility of any policymaker to care about it. So only in the last couple years have American politicians started to talk about it. Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio are two of them. There are some people in the Biden White House who have talked about it. None of these, I think, will be terribly effective, but it is starting to hit the radar screen here in Washington, D.C.
On the technology, you note a telling fact. The baby bust, as you say, began right around the time that the iPhone came around. What's the connection?
So
do you think?
I mean, it's a little bit of guesswork here, but when you look at the timing and when you think about your own life, your own brain, how it feels like it was rewired. My attention span is shorter. I sometimes find myself opening my phone and I don't even remember making the decision to do it. So we know it's a massive cultural thing. The iPhone isn't a tech story. It's a cultural story. And again, the theme I'm trying to hammer away at here is economics, policy. This other stuff can't tell the story of the baby bust. It can't tell the story of increased childhood anxiety. It can't tell the story of increased parental exhaustion. Culture has to do it. So smartphones and then social media, I think, have dramatically affected it. The most concrete way, and ask a parent of a millennial, and they probably know about this, certainly ask a millennial, it's messed up our dating world. I mean, my wife and we met through friends. I threw a party and I said to some girl, hey, make sure you bring your friends to my next party. And boom. And that was a normal way to do it. So there, when you're dating through the dating apps, it's a checklist. I don't know about all your listeners out there, but I would not have made all the checks on my wife's checklist. I'm 5'10". I'm not 6 feet tall. I'm balding. I don't have a thick head of hair. And so she probably would have crossed off journalists and Mets fans as well on the list. But when you're going through friends, common friends, you have a sort of an automatic background check, an automatic way to police your own behavior, police the other guy's behavior. And it's just a healthier way of dating. The dating apps, they give the men this illusion that there's infinite options because there are infinite women on the dating app. They turn everybody into perfectionists. They remove the sort of social support system of friends in common. So that's just one of many ways I think that the smartphones have delayed it. The bigger one, though, is I think it changes our perception of ourself and humanity. I think we start to see ourselves as self-determiners of ourselves. We're writing our own script in life from a blank page rather than seeing ourselves as people who fit into a broader story. People who are playing a role in a family, in a community, in an institution. And that self-determined, autonomous individual doesn't blend well with the reality of family.
Do you also, I'm going to maybe add something else, because I think you at least imply this, and that is that the social media side of things, which you remember back in the 90s, the internet was going to create this, you know, robust world of individualism and diverse opinion and so on. But you say it's actually generated a lot of intolerance and coercion. And that just makes social relations a little more tense. Are people more wary? Are they
Oh, certainly. If you go ahead and have a bad date, A, the language of the day can translate what you and I would have called awkward becomes traumatic. It becomes harm. Right. And then your bad date ends up as a topic of a social media post. And if you're unlucky, it goes viral. And so that's not, I mean, there are multiple men who have been subject of, how I was a victim of sexual assault. Then you read the story and it was a date that went really bad among two people who had agreed to, premarital, casual, consensual sex. And you just think, wow, there's a lot going wrong here, but all of it is multiplied by the reality of social media.
Yeah. On the birth rate issue, how do feminists and perhaps liberals generally explain the the lower birth rates?
So there is this popular concept that there's a divergence between our egalitarian sort of public sphere, but our still too patriarchal private sphere. And so women have so much more work opportunity now, so much more education than they used to. And, most people who graduate college in America today are women. A vast majority of people getting advanced degrees today are women. It's just overwhelmingly. They're climbing up to the ladders. They have the opportunities to take over companies. But mothers still do more parenting than fathers do, even though fathers do a lot more than they used to. And we could talk about that. But there's just this, they see, we just need to offset that familial demand on women's time, and then they'll be able to achieve true equality. And if they can achieve, if family doesn't get in the way of work anymore, and work doesn't get in the way of family anymore, maybe they'll be able to have more babies and have more work success. That's sort of the big theory. I call it the feminist fecundity theory, or the fecund feminism theory. And there was even a headline, want more babies, destroy the patriarchy.
Right.
So that was the theory.
You cite that in the book. You also cite, however, research showing, survey research. They ask women what they would like in their lifestyles. And most of them would generally prefer to work less and stay more at home. Now, do liberals and feminists just, ignore that?
Absolutely. That, so, I mean, if every mother in America could snap her fingers and get the job, the work-life situation she wants, what a vast majority would choose is part-time work where they are home to send their kids off to school, and they're home when the school bus drops off, or they're in the pickup line at 3 p.m. And that work is being done from home. That is what a vast majority. So that would mean a lot of mothers moving from full-time work in the office to part-time work where family comes first and work comes second. But what you see on the liberal side, and the Biden administration is the clearest example these days, but the op-ed pages of the major papers are the biggest example, is they think that what parents need is more subsidized daycare or government-provided daycare. That's not what most parents want. I mean, the most important survey on that is just two-thirds of parents say that the ideal is that parents work less, whether it's the mom, dad, or both, and take more time with the kids. Then you've got another portion that says the ideal situation is extended family or community. And it's a small minority that says the ideal situation is two full-time jobs and institutional daycare. Yeah, that's the only thing that our politicians seem to think, because they have their mind on gross domestic product more than they do on the actual domestic sphere. They have their minds on making families be more work friendly rather than jobs being more family friendly.
Well, one of the studies you cite is a German study that showed that more government supported nanny or daycare did not affect the birth rate. It didn't help. That is not a solution for correct. Women having more kids.
Because, and I go through the whole history of how there was a slight uptick in the birth rate when the Nordic countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, et cetera, started subsidizing daycare. So there clearly was some women who said, I would have another baby if I had daycare. But that quickly disappeared. And then, in fact, the more subsidized that daycare was, the lower the birth rate was. And my argument is a daycare subsidy isn't a family subsidy. It's a work subsidy.
Right.
And so a culture that says, hey, once you have kids, we'll take them off your hand. You go back to the office. That's a culture that ends up valuing work over family. And that drives down the birth rate. So the countries that were supposedly the feminist fecundity utopias, they had a rapid birth rate drop that was more than the average birth rate drop in Europe over the last 10 to 12 years.
Near the end of the book, you begin to look forward and speculate on something you call civilizational sadness. And you say something is happening in the American psyche. What does that term mean? What's going on?
It has to do with how we see ourselves. So some people who say they don't want kids, or they're really afraid of having kids, what they pin it on is they say, oh, it's about climate change. Or other people, this woman, Amanda, I interviewed in Maryland, she said, no, I think other people are the cancer of the earth.
Wonderful.
And, you know,
that means you and me.
Yes. And it also means Amanda. And so that's the key, that she's, if you see people as bad, you see yourself as bad, and then you don't want more of yourself. And this, I think, was clearly true. I point to the fact that after World War II, about 10 years later, Germany, Japan, and Italy had the lowest birth rates in the wealthy world. The three losers of World War II, the clear bad guys, or the people who didn't live up to their heroic self-image. And so why? Well, there was a perception of themselves being bad, or at least not being heroes. And what was the baby boom in the US? Why was it so much bigger than anywhere else? Because our men had just gone in two different directions, conquered two evil empires. Well, the women had kept the economy afloat. So they came back, they smooched on the pier, and they went back to the chapel, got married, and had a bunch of babies. I think that the spirit of the age that caused the baby boom was a belief greater than any point in modern American history that we were good, and that what was going on in Germany, Japan, and Italy was a belief that they were bad. And I think that right now, in the upper middle class, especially on the left side in America today, sort of middle, upper middle class, so wealthy white liberals, they don't believe that they're good. They believe they're causing climate catastrophe. They believe that America is inherently racist, and that this is just one instance of civilizational sadness, and that civilizational sadness is an underappreciated cause of low and falling birth rates. I use the word sadness because it's not just a self-hatred, but it's also linked to a hedonism, or a view that everything, you know, you should just take what you can at any given point, which itself is a sadness. And it's rooted in it's inevitable, I think, in a secularizing culture that doesn't see a higher purpose to life. We rejected God, and we became the sort of guilt-ridden fire and brimstone world that supposedly our preachers were giving us.
Tim, don't they know that to look at teenagers and tell them, you know, the world is in really bad shape and this country really isn't very good? This is the world they're entering. This is the place where they're going to call home. Don't they know how dispiriting this is for kids, for teenagers?
Yeah, especially when you don't offer them anything beyond the world.
Right.
I think
a
supernatural mindset. If you come at it, Christian hope is always a tricky thing to talk about. I don't want to try to promise my kids, the world will be better when you're my age and it is now, because I have no idea. But A, we tell them that the world is good and it's full of good things, and B, that there's something behind it, beyond it. And the secular mindset, just as a secular parent needs to think, needs to get their kid into an Ivy or, you know, a good job at a law firm to believe that their kid is good, I mean, that's an overstatement, but that's the sort of the logic taken to its extreme. They need to think the world will get better in order to think that human life is good. And if it looks to them like the world isn't going to get better, which, by the way, is also an error, the world's not on fire, et cetera. But in a secular mindset, you have to believe the world's getting better to have any hope. And right. You combine the irrational negative media coverage with that lack of a supernatural, and you get the civilizational sadness.
And then they're surprised that that millennials, and we'll see what happens with Gen Z, but the millennials are you know, depression, anxiety, you know, dysfunction, medication is keeps going up with these kids who are now 30 years old. Hey, how did that happen? Well, here we are. Anyway, there's more in the book, including some practical discussion of policy. But for now, the book is Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Kim Carney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.